In a world where most people watch movies and then forget about them, these brave heroes join forces to watch them again and then talk about them. Join them in their epic journey as they go back in time, a decade and beyond, to revisit and break down films from a vast array of genres. Do these movies hold up over time? Are they classics? Find out on Retro Movie Roundtable. Starring your hosts, Brian Fry, Chad Robinson, Destin Milbarnes, Lizzie Haynes, and Russell Guest. Coming now to headphones in your ears.
Welcome all you lords, ladies, and knights of the Retro Movie Roundtable to the podcast where we watch movies and then talk about them. I'm your host, Chad Robinson, and joining me today is my good friend and fellow sick co-host, Lizzie Haynes. Lizzie, how's the chicken soup over there?
I'm hanging in there. I'm going to do the best I can not to cough on air. But other than that, I'm great.
Yep. Yeah, same boat. No promises, but we soldier on here at the Roundtable. And we are very excited. We are bringing back a returning guest. It's been a while. Coming to you from Houston, Texas, Taylor Clawson. Taylor, thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me back.
If you want to hear more from Taylor, we did a excellent episode on Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, if I do say so myself. That's just such a fun movie to do.
So good.
Yeah. The music's great, and we've got another great music movie for you tonight. But before we do that, Russell has prepared some warm-up questions for us to get started. Taylor, I will start with you. What is a movie that had a poster or DVD cover you initially thought you would not love, but you ended up liking the movie?
Definitely Stardust.
I know.
I remember when it came out and I was seeing like previews for it and I was like, this movie looks dumb. And then I love Neil Gaiman, who's the author of the book it's based on, read it. The movie's very different, but then I watched the movie and was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I love this movie.
I think that's fair. That is terrible cover art.
Yeah.
Lizzie, what's your bad poster or DVD cover?
Honestly, I hate saying this, but Titanic. And if everyone can just like hold on here, the first time that I saw it, I was 9. So I didn't know what the actual like Titanic was. My mom just showed me a picture of like, we're going to go see this movie. It's about this ship. And I didn't know anything other than the fact that it was about a ship. And so I was very upset that my parents were dragging me to that movie. But then, you know, of course, you have Leo and Kate and you fall madly in love with it. But I, again, being 9, I didn't have a lot of history, so I'm just thinking I'm going to see a movie about a boat.
That's fair. I saw that in my 7th grade field trip, and we got two warnings. We had the history of the Titanic, so I'm sitting there for 3 hours thinking, when is this going to sink? But we had also been prepped of, hey, there's going to be female nudity. Please do not cheer or catcall or do whatever. You're telling this to 7th grade boys. You might as well be giving them the green light. That is exactly what we did. Probably wouldn't have had we not been told. For me, this is a movie I really love. The Babysitter. If you pay attention to the artwork for The Babysitter on Netflix, it's Samara Weaving. You just see her back and she's got a knife in one hand and she has a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in another. But if you pay attention to the art, they're both right hands. So this is like some AI-generated art that just failed utterly. And it's just a terrible graphic. But the movie is excellent. Samara Weaving is just a gem. Taylor, what is the last movie you saw?
So in theaters, Coraline. It recently re-released because Leica, the studio that made it, has an exhibit going on in Seattle. And so they re-released a bunch of their movies in theaters. And so my husband and I went and saw Coraline. Just in general, Lord of the Rings. It was recently my birthday, and my husband got me the gigantic Rivendell set for my birthday.
Nice.
And so it was like, well, I'm going to build it. Got to put on the whole trilogy.
That, all of that is awesome. Coraline, I went into blind, and I just mm-hmm. picked it. My daughter at the time was 4. I said, this is a kid's movie. Sure, why not? Yep, buttons for eyes, straight horror yeah. movie. That bad choice. Bad parenting choices.
Well, there's a fun story about how, because it's a book based on also a Neil Gaiman book, how it got labeled as a children's book. He sent it to his publisher. His publisher wasn't sure, you know, is this adult horror? Is this children? Is it middle grade? Is it young adult? And so she read it to her children, who were like 7, 9, and 11 or something like that at the time. And her thing was, whenever one of them says, okay, it's too scary, then like that's the cutoff for the age group. And she read the whole thing through. None of her kids ever said it was scary. And then Neil Gaiman met her kids like a couple years later. And her 7-year-old told him, this book is absolutely terrifying, but I had to know how it ended. So I wouldn't tell mom that it was scary because I knew she'd stop reading it to me.
Oh, it's a straight horror movie.
Yeah.
Lizzie, what was the last movie that you saw?
We saw Night Swim in theaters.
Haunted swimming pool.
Yes, and it speaks to like a deep-seated fear that I have from an Are You Afraid of the Dark episode. And I don't know, I didn't love it. That's kind of the best way that I can describe it. I liked it, but I really wanted to love it. There were people, it was Aaron, myself, and then one other couple were the only people in the theaters, and the other couple behind us were actually angry when they left the theater. Like, they were visibly and audibly mad. So if that gives you any kind of indication.
Yeah, I was somewhere in between there. Okay. This is a goofy concept, but it could be fun.
I would have enjoyed it more if I was like watching it in my basement and it was just like a free stream rather than seeing it in the theaters. There's certain movies that kind of deserve the caliber of the theater. That was not fun, but it was really fun to like do a double feature. We saw that in Mean Girls, and so it was a fun date night.
You're totally right, though. This should be like a Hulu movie or something, like Night mm-hmm. Swim presented by Hulu. That's fun. I watched one of your favorite actors, Lizzie, and Jason Statham. I saw The Beekeeper. I know you are not a Jason Statham guy.
I am not, no.
Your husband would have a good time. It's a fun popcorn flick. It's a good time. Nice. Just don't try and think too deeply about anything that happens. So before that, it was the Barbie movie. My wife rented the Barbie movie, so we checked that out. That was a good time.
Nice.
Thoroughly enjoyed that. But Lizzie, what movie are we doing tonight?
We are going to talk about The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Very good. Stars Tom Hulce. At least that's how the internet says I should pronounce his last name. I had no idea. Demi Moore, Tony Jay, Kevin Klein, Paul Kendall, and Jason Alexander. It is released in 1996 with a budget of $70 million. It grosses $100 million domestically, which puts it at 15 for the year. The movie that comes in ahead of it is Eraser. And the movie that placed right behind it is Michael with John Travolta. The number one movie that year is Independence Day. We have covered it. Check it out. It's our episode 167. IMDb gives this a 7.0. The critics at Rotten Tomato give it a 71%, and the audience or Stride for Stride at 70%. It does get some Academy Award nominations, Best Original Music or Comedy Score, Golden Globe nominee for Best Original Score. Golden Reel, it wins 3 for Animated Motion Picture, Sound Editing, and Music Editing. Saturn Award, it wins Best Motion Picture for an Animated or Mixed Media. It does win a Razzie as well for Worst Written Film, grossing over $100 million. That's a weird category. That's a weird category. AFI, there are no distinctions, so it's not making it in the Animated Hall of Fame right now. AFI has no love for it. Taylor, we'll start with you. Had you seen The Hunchback of Notre Dame? And if you had, what was it like coming back this time?
Oh, I've seen it several times. I saw it when it came out in theaters when I was a little kid. This time I was paying particular attention to the animation of it. So still a great movie. parts of it are a little silly, but it is rated G and it's meant to be a kid's movie. So, you know.
Yeah, we'll have some discussion about that later, because it almost wasn't, and some of the actors weren't so comfortable with it. Yeah. Lizzie, had you seen Hunchback, and what was it like returning for you?
I saw it as a kid, and this was not in my typical rotation as a kid. I definitely saw it, but I had my quintessential Disney movies of, like, you know, like The Lion King and Beauty and the Beast and so forth and so on. And this was not one of those that I requested to watch over and over again. So there was a lot about this movie that I forgot about. Pretty much after, like, Topsy Turvy Day, I remember looking over at Aaron being like, I don't remember anything else after this. Like, I remember watching this part of the movie about 1,000 times, and then I literally couldn't tell you what happens next. And so a part of me felt like I was watching a lot of this fresh. I have to say I'm kind of surprised that it's rated G. I feel like watching it with adult eyes and understanding the adult themes, I'm like, this is a very heavy pill to swallow for a child's movie and really, really big themes. But, you know, if you're watching it with the lens of in the 90s, I feel like so many things were made with the intent that it was going to fly right over your kid's head. And it certainly did mine. So I guess in that context, it works. But in terms of a kid's movie and it being enjoyable, it definitely has that 90s animated Disney movie feel. And it absolutely has its sweet moments.
Yeah, and I'm kind of like you, Lizzie. I hadn't seen this movie in 20-ish years, close to. It's just been forever. I can remember my roommate in college had watched this and he would cry. And I don't get that kind of emotion with this movie. This is not The Fox and the Hound for me. That is something as an adult male near 40 that I still avoid. they will not always be friends. That will make me cry every time. This movie, it's interesting revisiting. I forgot how dark it is. Like, the very opening for me, just thinking, did you have to go this hard, Disney, this quickly? And what's interesting to me is I think this movie, because it's somewhat true to the novel, they change a lot, and we'll get into that. It uses some terms that have fallen out of favor. So practically every song uses the word gypsy. I'm not really confident when that word became, you know, taboo. It's been some time in the last 20 years, but it was not in 1996. No. We get that in every single song. So it may come up in this podcast. Just so everyone knows, it's no longer the preferred term. It's Roma or Romani people. So it is a little interesting hearing that come up throughout this entire movie. This is not something I feel like Disney would make at this point. In fact, I was talking to my wife. I feel like they just said, hey, Hunchback is out of copyright. And just like Little Mermaid, just like Aladdin, just like Beauty and the Beast, let's make this out of copyright story Disney-fied. And they started to make it, and then they, without reading the book, and then they said, oh no, what have we done? Where do we go with this? and we'll get to this, all these interesting, unique parts of this movie in a minute, but if you haven't seen it, put us on pause, go watch Hunchback of Notre Dame, and we'll be right back to spoil it for you.
Welcome to the All 80s Movies Podcast.
I'm Bill.
And I'm Jason. And this is the podcast where we talk about the blockbusters, the flops, and everything in between from one of the freshest decades for movies, the 1980s. So whether you're a brain, a jock, a valley girl, or a Jedi, we've got some 80s classics for you.
Do these movies stand the test of time? Are we discovering something new? Is there an 80s movie we're finally watching for the first time?
Join us each week as we dive into the cinematic nostalgia that inspired and influenced a generation. From the hits to the cult classics, we'll discuss our earliest memories, favorite scenes, fun facts, and our not-so-favorite movie moments, too.
It's the All 80s Movies Podcast, now available on all major streaming platforms. Please subscribe and happy listening.
And we're back. Last warning before Lizzie spoils this movie for you. If you haven't seen The Hunchback of Notre Dame since 1996, please go check it out. Great music. Lizzie, spoil it for us.
15th century Paris, we meet Judge Frollo, a heretic whose mission to rid Paris of, quote, gypsies at any cost is fueled by his own hatred and marketed to the people as righteousness. In an attempt to arrest a group of gypsies, he kills one holding a baby in her arms. Frollo has a crisis of conscience outside the Notre Dame and takes pity on the baby, whose features are unlike anything he's seen before. The baby is given a cruel nickname, Quasimodo, and lives in the bell tower of Notre Dame to live out his days. His only friends are gargoyles and Frollo, who conditions Quasimodo to believe that he's an unlovable monster who will never be accepted amongst the people of Paris. Quasimodo, desperate to venture outside, meets Esmeralda, a gypsy who is as kind as she is beautiful. She befriends Quasimodo and searches for sanctuary in the church. Meanwhile, the new captain Phoebus has been ordered to arrest her, but can't, as he has fallen in love with her. Together, Quasimodo and Phoebus work together to save Esmeralda and her gypsy family, but not before they encounter Frollo one last time, and he meets the same fire he attended for them. The people declare Quasimodo a hero, and he finally feels the love he has waited a lifetime to experience.
Very good. And this, like I alluded to, this is based on a Victor Hugo novel. This is classic Disney. Take a public domain story, put their own spin on it. Anyone here read the novel? Are you familiar with The Hunchback of Notre Dame?
I did read the book a couple of years ago.
You did? So seeing this movie, it's a little different, right?
Yeah. A little bit. The ending is where they take the most liberties.
You've got to have a happy Disney ending instead of Esmeralda's hanged and Quasimodo goes off and dies next to her skeleton.
It's funny you say that, because after the movie came out, Disney made a music, like a stage musical, like they do with several of their properties, and they kept the original Victor Hugo ending.
Oh.
She doesn't get hanged. She dies from smoke inhalation, but Quasimodo also dies.
Oh, okay. That's not very Disney happily ever after.
I was very surprised by that.
Yeah, there's a lot around Esmeralda that's changed if you're interested in the novel. Yeah. Phoebus gets, it's more lust than love, and he then gets stuck with this awful woman that he hates, and he's engaged to Fleur-de-Lys. And Frollo actually attempts to rape Esmeralda. There's good reason why Disney does not put that in here. Instead, we get hair sniffing. Yeah. So that was what we get as the illusion. I'll start with you, Taylor. It's really unusual that Disney covers religion. They try not to get their feet wet. We do get some Greek mythology a year later with Hercules, but rarely do we get direct references to Mary. We get shots of Jesus as well. How do you feel like this film stands out compared to Disney's other works?
I feel like they did a good job balancing, showing the church in an unkind light, but also showing it in a good light at the same time, if that makes sense. Like, the archdeacon is the one who stops Frollo from killing Quasimodo at the beginning. But at the same time, you have Esmeralda's song where she's talking about, you know, God help my people who are outcasts. And you have the other Christians who are in there and they're praying for fame and wealth and those kind of things.
Yeah, you get that lovely shot next to the statue of Mary of I Wonder If You Were Ever an Outcast Too, which is an allusion to Egypt, as she is chased into Egypt because of King Herod's proclamation. So yeah, it was very interesting to see. How about you, Lizzie? How does this movie stand out amongst the Disney canon?
Well, I really love, I mean, I'm a Christian myself, and I really love just the beauty of the movie. It's like just very picturesque and gorgeous in the way that they picture the church itself. And, you know, even though I myself am a Christian, I can completely acknowledge that church hurt is a real thing. You know, people are really truly damaged by people who take probably more so the law of Moses from the Old Testament and really apply it to and what Frollo's doing, where he has his own personal motivations, but he masks it as righteousness. And that happens a lot today too. So I think it happens and it's real. But Taylor, like what you were saying also, you have like the archdeacon who is the supposed to be like the like the holiest man amongst the people in this movie. And he's the one that really is more of a true representation of what it means to be graceful and merciful. And then with Esmeralda and Quasimodo, and, you know, really, if you look at like Jesus's Sermon on the Mount, he talks about like the people who really truly are blessed. It's like the poor in spirit and the people who are meek and people who hungry and thirst, and like that, because these are the people that understand really what's truly important and what really matters. And so with Esmeralda and Quasimodo, they're kind of good examples of two people that really have understood what it's felt to be rejected and therefore are looking at other people and treating them with grace and with love. And ultimately that's really what Jesus wants for us. So it is, in a really well-rounded way, an accurate depiction of how the church is meant to be a beautiful tool to bring people together, but if put in the wrong hands, it can be destructive.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I love the line about Frollo, how he sees corruption everywhere but within himself. And so
love that, yes.
Yeah.
This is France, but it's very reminiscent of the Inquisition. And later on, we see various religious and non-religious portions that are persecuting the Roma people. So we get that as well. This is not a new thing. It crops up again in Germany during World War II. They're a very persecuted people. So that's an interesting topic. We kind of talked about how this is a very dark, mature movie. Very rarely do we get coverings for lust. Very rarely do we get religious fanaticism. And honestly, Disney, until lately, doesn't really cover themes of injustice very much. Mm-hmm. Like, you might pick on Belle because she's a girl that likes books. This is a little different of we are locking disabled people in towers and persecuting outsiders, others. And Jason Alexander, who's in this film as one of the gargoyles, he said he could not take his 4-year-old to this movie. He said it's not for him. He felt it was too dark. And this film was initially rated PG. So we did talk about that a little in the beginning. You guys want to guess why it was rated PG? And we've listed a lot, but it's actually kind of funny why it was rated PG.
Is it Quasimodo's alphabet lesson at the beginning of the film?
Oh, that is fantastic, though. That is so fantastic. F is for festival. No. No, forgiveness. No.
I'm assuming it's the Hellfire song. I would think that that's probably I was trying to decide. Aaron got distracted. We were watching it together. And he got distracted. He came back and he's like, okay, what did I miss? And I was like, Frollo's singing this song of like, I've gotten some tingles and jingles for this for this woman. I don't know how to deal with it, so I'm just gonna kill her.
Right. Yeah, she will marry me or I will burn her alive.
Yes. The entire city of Paris.
So like that's an adult theme, really, of like, I don't know how to process my feelings. You're a witch, it's your fault.
Right. Yes. It was part of Hellfire, although it's not the word hell, which gets mentioned quite a bit. It was the word sin. For whatever reason, really? Mentioning sin in a G-rated movie is a no-no. And so you'll notice when Frollo says, driving me to sin, there's a big musical crescendo and it drowns out the word. That was intentional. And the other thing that got it rated PG of all things was Frollo sniffing Esmeralda's hair. It was a louder sound effect. And so they had to tone down this sniffing in order to get down to a G.
The kids didn't know.
Yeah, it's not torture. It's not threats of hanging people or burning them at the stake or throwing babies down the well. It is hair sniffing and the word sin. Who who knows what the MPAA is doing, but
bizarre.
That was their requirement. So in this film, we get a love triangle. We mentioned earlier the differences between the books and the book and the movie, but are you okay with how Disney does Quasimodo in the end? Like, does he really get his happy ending? Or do you want him with Esmeralda?
I appreciate that they did not have him and Esmeralda get together. In my opinion, some of the best Disney movies are the ones that kind of subvert your expectations at the end. Like, spoiler for several Disney movies coming up, like Frozen, Hans is the bad guy and not the prince. Yes. And Wreck-It Ralph, where he's, you know, he stays the villain, but everybody appreciates him more. You know, that those kind of endings, I like those better.
I also think that I completely agree with you, Taylor. I think that it's better that way. But, you know, really what Quasimodo wanted was love and acceptance. But when you really think about it, he's been completely suppressed his entire life. Like, you couldn't jump. I mean, if we act like Esmeralda and Quasimodo get together in the end and they get married, it's like when you really think about it, he just, like, the fundamentals on how to live with people, he does not know how to do. And I just think that, like, this idea of his happy ending is now being able to unlearn so many things that he was conditioned to believe. And so this idea of he gets to learn how to love himself in a way that he was, because he was always taught to hate himself almost. And so, you know, I think that it would be very unbelievable to think that he'd go from this place of a lot of, like, self-hatred and repression to then being able to, like, be in a relationship. You know, I think that, like, the reality is it's a good idea to just be and, like, explore what it's like to have friends and live with other people and be a part of a community. And I think he looked at Esmeralda as his ticket to joy. And then I think towards the end of the movie, you know, he places Esmeralda's hand inside Phoebus's because he realizes, like, they're really in love. And I think he's truly okay with it, because at that point, when that little girl goes up and hugs him and embraces him, and that is when he realizes, okay, like, I don't actually need, like, quote, true love. It's just this fact that people are allowing me or accepting me, and then therefore, like, really allowing me to accept myself. I think that was a really sweet way to end it.
Those are good points. I mean, we don't have the term in 1996, but this is pretty much gaslighting the movie. That's all Furlough is doing. He's telling him, oh, your mother abandoned you. I'm your only friend. Everyone out there will hate you. And he is remarkably well adjusted for having that mentality drilled into his head. A is for abomination, things like that. So yeah, I think you both make excellent points. This, it would have ended poorly if they get together. Like, you've been in a bell tower for, I don't know, 16, 18 years, however long he's supposed to be. You're going to be a little maladjusted. Let Phoebus be happy. Let Esmeralda be happy. And she is really, Esmeralda's our focal point of this movie. She is the one that everybody is just smitten by, for better or worse. So what makes her so compelling?
I think the obvious is that she's beautiful. And, you know, the dancing and all of that. But I think truly, you have the people of Paris, and who are kind of debaucherous is probably, like, the best way to describe them. And then you have Frollo, who's just this, I don't even know what we would call him, like a Pharisee gone bad. I don't know exactly how we would want to call that, but he's just this evil person. And so you have kind of these two hyperbolic extremes of one another. And Esmeralda is, like, the only person who really has, like, a sense of humanity up until we meet Phoebus, who I believe does as well. But I think that's what's so kind of disarming about her, is that you expect her to just kind of be one of the people, but she's the only one who sees Quasimodo for more than just his appearance and has mercy on him and grace on him. And so just, I think that whole combination of the beauty on the inside, on the outside.
Yeah. Like Lizzie was saying, part of it is just, she's, you know, gorgeous. And so everybody likes that, but she is sweet to she's very nice to Quasimodo. You know, she has her whole God Help the Outcast song where she's talking about helping her people. Yeah, she is just very caring about others in general. And that, I think that's another thing, not Frollo so much because he doesn't care about that part, but that's definitely what attracts Phoebus and Quasimodo to her.
I do like that she's not entirely helpless. She does wind up needing save, really, I think it's twice in the film, but especially at the Festival of Fools, she does that neat little counting of, she counts to 10 and she's like, nope, not enough. Yeah. Not enough. So she's very, very capable and she's very relaxed. Quasimodo stumbles in on her dressing. Hmm. And instead of doing the typical like shriek cover up thing, she's just like, oh, hey, nice mask. Mm-hmm. How are you doing? So she's very relaxed. Even with somebody like Phoebus, she's gentle and caring. And he is laying it on thick of, it might have pierced your heart. Oh, I think it already has. It's like, all right, buddy. All right. You don't have to go that strong.
Right.
So we do, it's not a Disney film if we don't have animal or inanimate objects as companions. And we get two sets of them for this film. We have Achilles the horse, and I am absolutely positive they named him Achilles just so they could do that little tiny joke of Achilles, heel.
Yep, that's right. I agree.
It's been a while since I've read the book, but I'm pretty sure the horse had no name. We do get Jolly the goat, who is in the novel. Mm-hmm. And then our other sets are the gargoyles, Victor, Hugo, see what they did there, and Laverne. So for me, I kind of felt like both sets of these companions were far less present than what we get in other films. Like they're almost ancillary to what's going on, but I'll start with you, Taylor. Did the companions work for you? Do you like the gargoyle songs? Do you like Jolly the Goat?
I don't care for the gargoyles. We could do without.
I'm right there with you.
I mean, I understand Jolly. I'm fine with that. Achilles, like, it's a silly joke, but he's not in the movie that much. But the gargoyles were just too much. It was weird having Jason Alexander as one of them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jason Alexander's a big Broadway guy, so he does do musicals, but it is very much Jason Alexander loudly talking, George Costanza and Gargoyle.
I haven't even watched Seinfeld, and that's all I could think was one of the guys from Seinfeld in this.
I love him, and he was in Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella with like Brandy and Whitney Houston.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So good. Like the prince is having a ball and he was so good. Oh my gosh. He's so good. So he is like, he has chops, but it fell flat for me. I don't think it was necessarily his fault, but I just think the gargoyles were lame. I hate saying it, but they were.
I feel like they tried to replicate the Lion King of, here we're going to have three companions for you. Yes. One of them was an sister act. We're going to recycle the same thing. Yep. So it was Mary Wicks who plays Laverne. She is from Sister Act. She's one of the nuns instead of Whoopi Goldberg that we get in Lion King. But I'm with you both. The gargoyles just need to go away. They didn't add anything for me. He could have just very well talked to them and they never talked back and I would have been just as happy.
That actually probably would have been more charming, honestly.
Yeah. We get that kind of very mean scene from Frollo of, does stone talk? No, master. But what we do love animal companions, but here at the round table, we do love a good villain. And boy, do we have one with Minister Frollo. And Russell's not here, but we do love Liss. So I'd love to hear where Minister Frollo ranks among your Disney canon. Like, where is he in the villain canon? And where does his song Hellfire rank? Taylor?
I mean, just the fact that he's Tony J is voicing him automatically like jumps him way up the list. As far as villain song, I would say like him, Scar in Lion King, and Dr. Facilier in Princess and the Frog have like the best villain songs.
I've got friends.
You copied my list perfectly. I like 100% agree with you. Like the Shadow Man is unbelievable, but yeah. Scar, I feel like comes right just one step above because Jeremy Irons is just unbelievable. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he is evil. Like he just has such an apathy for the Romani people and for Quasimodo, honestly, and really for like everybody else around him. Like he doesn't even really care about his own people. You hear him talk about his own people and he just refers to them as, I'm paraphrasing, but just kind of like debaucherous fools. Like he really doesn't care. And then at the very end, when he tries to catch Esmeralda, he doesn't care who he has to burn in order to find her. Like he really does not care who gets in his way.
Yeah, setting all of Paris alight and then blaming her for doing that, and that this woman is driving him to sin. You all have pretty much nailed my list as well. Scar's Be Prepared is number one for me. The imagery and everything is just, it's another level. I think that's the best that they've ever done. But Minister Frollo himself, he's my number one villain. I just think there's nothing redeemable about this guy. He is just reveling in being evil, but the fact that he doesn't see it himself. He's not Cruella de Vil of I'm going to kill puppies and make a coat. He just straight up thinks he's doing the right thing, and that makes it far more terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
I'm going to manipulate everyone. And to Taylor's point, Tony J's voice is just, there's something menacing. Just menace drips out of every word he says, even if it's meant and kindness of my dear Quasimodo. It's just this, it's deliciously evil. So he is fantastic for me.
Yeah, I agree. His voice is so scary. I mean, there's some people that I will say, like, I would love for them to read me a book to sleep. He's like the kind that they just want like far, far, far away. He is so scary. And I bet he's probably very sweet in real life, but that'd be a creepy grandpa.
Well, he is in another Disney movie too. Very small role, but he is the asylum keeper in Beauty and the Beast.
Yes, he is.
And it's one of those, as soon as he starts talking, you're like, oh.
Yes. Crazy old Maurice.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. He takes the money. Mm-hmm. I did want Frollo to keep when he's hunting the Roma people. We get the 10 silver and we get the 20 silver. I thought we would get to 30 to go for biblical illusions.
And
we did not get 30 pieces of silver, but that would have been interesting. And the verse he quotes at the end doesn't actually exist.
He shall smite the wicked.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was a little strange. Maybe they're like, hey, we've gone hard on religion. We're not going to pull directly from the Bible, but there's
I had thought that was from the Witch's Hammer.
Mm.
It was a book written by witch hunters in like the 1400s or 1500s.
Okay, like that would be appropriate.
Malefice something.
Okay.
I think it's from that. I could be wrong.
All right. I was just thinking, if you're going to start pulling out Bible verses, there are plenty of metal Bible verses about slaying the wicked or striking them from Isaiah 11:4, things like that. So it was interesting. I immediately looked up, said, is this actually a verse that he's quoting? But it may be from a book that you're mentioning. As far as alternate casting, these are always fun. Cyndi Lauper was our first actor that was cast. She thought she was going to get to be Esmeralda, which that's a very different take. But they cast her as a gargoyle named Quinn, and she was eventually released from the role. Arsenio Hall, David Letterman, and Jay Leno were also considered to play gargoyles. Ultimately, it goes to Jason Alexander. And the gargoyles were originally named Chaney, Lawton, and Quinn after Lon Chaney, who's a horror great, Charles Lawton, and Anthony Quinn. All three of the men played the Hunchback of Notre Dame. So that was a fun illusion, But the problem is all three were still living, and Disney's legal department was really afraid of getting sued because they didn't ask for permission to use their names. So they changed it to Victor Hugo for the author, and then Laverne. I actually don't know what Laverne's a reference to. Katzenberg wanted Meatloaf for Quasimodo. That would have been a fun one because Tom Hulce actually does sing his own parts. He's very talented. Meatloaf passed on the role, and Mandy Patinkin from Princess Bride fame and Inigo Montoya himself was approached, but he went in to record some lines and he disagreed with the producers so much that they just said, this can't work. I don't know why you cast Mandy Patinkin for a French Quasimodo, but that I'll listen to it. I think Tom Hulce did a wonderful job. And Anthony Hopkins was originally considered for Frollo, but he turned it down.
That would have been really interesting.
Yeah.
He's really, really good. I mean, Tony Jay is amazing too, but I kind of want to hear alternate universes Anthony Hopkins. Same. So he's great. And we do get a fun one. Fred Welker, who is the voice of Jolly the Goat, he doesn't get a whole lot of lines, but that is Mr. Scooby-Doo. So he had been voicing Scooby-Doo since 1969. Or Fred Jones, and then he voices Scooby-Doo in 2002. So he's been around. He's been a voice actor forever. This is produced by Don Hahn, and it's a screenplay by Tab Murphy. Our directors are Gary Trousdale and Kirk Wise. They work together quite a bit. So they're most famous for Beauty and the Beast. So that was their first director for Gary in 1991. Gary goes downhill, though, after Hunchback. He gets Atlantis, The Lost Empire. That did not go well for Disney. And then it gets much, much, much worse. He gets The Madagascar Penguins in A Christmas Caper, Shrek the Halls, Scared Shrekless, The Thriller Night, The Pig Who Cried Werewolf, and Rocky and Bullwinkle from 2014, which is a direct-to-video short. So, yeah, he peaked early, poor guy. Like, you get Beauty and the Beast, nail that, knock it out of the park, and then just everything else falls. He does do a lot of other things, though. He works as storyboard artist, as pre-production creative consultant. So he's doing a lot of other things for Disney. Kirk Wise is kind of the same thing. He gets additional credits for stuff like Paws of Fury. So I don't know how that works, but he does work with Spirited Away, the U.S. production of that. Spirited Away is an amazing Studio Ghibli movie. Go check that out. And Taylor, it's time to call on your expertise. You are an architect, so let's talk a little bit about, it's an animated movie, so we can't say set design, but our location is 1482 Paris. Did they do 1482 Paris justice? How was the architecture?
They definitely did Notre Dame justice. They made that cathedral a supporting actor in this movie, and they did it very well. Yeah, this is one movie that's not the first, but early use of CGI, and they use it excellently to show the cathedral and just different parts of it, and Quasimodo swinging around the outside, and the stained glass on the inside is expertly done. They did a fantastic job with the setting.
Yeah, the team studied Gothic architecture extensively to recreate the cathedral. I had this note. It's like they even went to Paris to research, which I would hope so.
Oh, yeah. Right. I don't doubt that.
Like, no need for the word even there. You need to go to Paris if you're doing this.
Required. Yeah. Yeah.
But it is, you're right with the cathedral. It is stunning. And especially I'm reminded, I don't remember how many years ago, but the cathedral burning and so much of it lost. Mm-hmm. It was really nice to see this intact Notre Dame and all of its glory depicted with such attention to detail. Lizzie, did you feel like the cathedral was its own character for this story as well?
Yes, I love the way you put that, Taylor. It really is. In all of the music, everything is kind of always brought back to this home base of Notre Dame. The church itself, the cathedral itself, is just so big and spectacular. Visually, it's a supporting actor, but then also it plays such an important role throughout the movie because of the fact that it's sanctuary. Mm-hmm. And so truly in all different aspects, it's absolutely a character, a supporting role for the movie.
Well, and even at the end, because up until the end, you could just say, oh, the gargoyles are just Quasimodo's imagination. But then at the very end, when Frollo's holding onto a gargoyle, it comes to yes. life and scares him. And it's like the cathedral itself is being like, no, get off.
Yeah, we don't want to claim you. Yeah, that's exactly what it's doing.
Yeah, that was terrifying because his eyes had turned orange right before that. And then you get the much more powerful gargoyle. I do like the idea of the cathedral rejecting him because he'd already spilled blood on the cathedral once. Mm-hmm. I guess the archdeacon is outranked because he's minister of justice. Ironic title, but it's like, you've already spilled blood once. You've committed murder once. Don't do it again. Mm-hmm. And just, which is a weird turn of phrase of like, hey, maybe don't murder the baby you're about to throw down the well. You've already killed his mother. But yeah, the cathedral is remarkable. And Taylor, you brought up the early usage of CGI. They're using it in the crowd scenes. It's mm-hmm. used in Feast of Fools. It's used in the climax. And it's hugely innovative at this time because before for something like this, you would typically get still shots of the crowd mm-hmm. and you would get the animation of the main characters, but the crowd's not doing anything. Here, there are 72 specific movements that they could have, and it's jumping, it's clapping, and everywhere in between. In each person, they had 6 options. You could be male or female, and then average weight, fat, or thin. And so this was one of the first Disney films to extensively use CGI for those crowd scenes and complex backgrounds. And I didn't notice it. Like it looks hand-drawn to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's sometimes early CGI, especially as we get closer to the 2000s and we discover, oh, this is neat. Let's play with this. It looks terrible in future films. Our soundtrack is by the absolute wonderful, one of the greatest of all time, Alan Menken. He is an EGOT winner. Check out his body of work. It is ridiculous. He gets The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Pocahontas. Each of those wins him 2 Academy Awards with Howard Ashman. Ashman died in 1991 working on Aladdin. Menken also composed songs for Little Shop of Horrors, Newsies. He does the wonderful gospel choir in Hercules, Home on the Range. I can't say I've seen that animated movie, but Enchanted is wonderful. And one of my favorites is Tangled. He does Tangled as well. So one day we will hopefully get to Tangled. I have gone to bat for that movie many times. But he's won a total of 8 Academy Awards, and he deserves it. I'll ask Taylor first. I feel like this is one of the best soundtracks that we have in Disney, just because it's so unique. We have a lot of Latin. We have a lot of just this dark themes. Was there a song that stood out to you?
Oh, man. This is one of those that's really hard to pick. The intro song, Bells of Notre Dame, like, I love it. It's great storytelling out there. So, you know, Disney, they have all sorts of representation of different properties in their parks. Obviously, this is not one of them, but in their big fireworks show that they do every night at the Magic Kingdom, they play Out There as part of that show because it's such a good song. And then the back-to-back of Heaven's Light and Hellfire is just phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah, those are all great choices. Lizzie, you said you were a Festival of Fools type of topsy-turvy day. Was that
Well, I remember that song because I have to be totally honest, that scene, there's a big reason why I only remember that part is because I had a really hard time watching that scene because they're so mean to him that it really bothered me a lot. Like I have a really hard time when I'm watching people just be like outwardly cruel to each other. Even as a kid, you can tell, even Aaron will attest that, what movie was there, some Will Smith movie? seven pounds, where he's yelling at Woody Harrelson. And I was like, we have to turn this off, like, right now. Like, I'm not watching the rest of this movie. I literally don't care. Like, I'm not going to watch this. Like, it was just so hard to watch them doing that to him. So topsy-turvy for me, I almost makes me anxious because I know what's coming afterwards. But I really like God Help the Outcasts. I think that that's a really unique, very mature song to have in a Disney movie. And it's, you know, it's a really beautiful song about truly somebody just like reaching out to God and not for her own need. You know, they make sure to put in there, you have the people, like you were saying, Taylor, who are asking for fame or beauty and fortune, whereas what she's like, I ask for nothing, and she just wants the people around her to be safe, and she's has very noble goals. And so that's a very mature song to put in there, but it's also really beautiful. And Hellfire for me just feels just so wicked. It's just like deliciously wicked. So I mean, the music is just absolutely amazing. Alan Menken is a juggernaut. I mean, there really is nobody like him. He's unbelievable.
It is amazing. You mentioned during Topsy Turvy making you anxious. Like, what is it about the 15th century that everyone just has fruit available within arm's reach? Like, whenever something upsets you, you just have fruit in arm's reach to throw at somebody. Just
got that tomato chilling in your pocket, ready to go.
Right.
Yeah, it's just so mean. It's like, I mean, the tomato throwing is one thing, but then it's like they just wrap all the ropes around him and tie him down, spin him. It's just like at some point, like, why were we doing this? Like, it is just so cruel. And that's what makes you love Esmeralda. She's the only person that's willing to stand up for him, especially understanding what the cost of that is going to be, standing up against Frollo.
They do wind up cheering his ugliness, which I guess is sort of nice. I mean, that's probably the best you can expect for 15th
Congratulations,
century.
Congratulations, you're the ugliest peasants. Person in the room. It's like, thank you. I mean,
yeah, I don't know. I think at that point he's taking that award and that attention. Like, okay. Yeah. He already identifies as a monster, which is very sad. It's very tragic to hear anyone just say, I'm ugly, I'm a monster, but he seems to take it somewhat in stride. I wish that there were more Latin ominous background music. Mm-hmm. Sanctuary is what really struck me, of just having, I can't even tell what they're saying, and it doesn't matter. Just having that cathedral type grand choir in the background, mm-hmm. chanting, and there's just menace. You get some of it in Hellfire. The Bells of Notre Dame is, Taylor said it, it's amazing storytelling.
Yeah, it really is.
I love, what's his name, Clopin?
Clopin, yeah.
Yes, the little puppeteer that's telling it through his puppets and the storybooks. That's a very unique opening until we get Frollo's horse, which looks like it's straight out of hell. It doesn't have pupils, it doesn't... It's a very menacing horse for no good reason.
And he has an attachment to him even when Phoebus gets on the horse. He's like, don't hit the horse. Don't hit the horse.
Right. And they're firing like 1,000 arrows. There's no way they're not hitting that horse. I don't care what they're doing. But yeah, I said it before, this soundtrack, it's one of my favorites because it's just so unique. It's something that I can listen to. I will also go to the Tarzan soundtrack, though, on the opposite end of the spectrum, because Phil Collins makes me happy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we used to listen to Trash in the Camp, which is a ridiculous song. We would listen to that at our camps. And complete gibberish, but I probably still have it memorized. Talking about great things, are you all ready to hand out some superlatives?
Yes.
Sure.
Taylor, we will start with you. MVP of The Hunchback of Notre Dame can be a director, actor, supporting actor. Who is your MVP?
Menken and Schwartz.
Oh, okay.
The lyricist and the composer, like they knocked it out of the park.
Great choices.
Yeah.
I think it was such a smart idea to have that Hellfire theme throughout. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just the undertone of it. And then we get the big payoff with an amazing villain song.
Well, and the whole, like, I didn't realize this until this last time I watched it. The whole time that Frollo is singing Hellfire, the background vocals are saying Mea Culpa.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, that's so awesome.
He's sitting there talking about, you know, these are all the bad things I want to do. And underneath you've got the Mea Culpa, Mea Culpa, Mea Culpa.
Oh, that's wonderful. I didn't know that.
It's really cool.
That is awesome. Lizzie, what did you choose?
I went with Tony J. I think that he elevates this movie as a villain in a way where this movie almost stays burned in your brain because of him. So for me, it's got to be Tony J.
Yeah, even if I wasn't the typical villain guy, like that's who I'm rooting for. I am not rooting for Frollo here, by the way. He is just too evil. This is beyond, like, usually I'm on board with the villains. He is too evil, but he is wonderful. Tony J's voice is just, it's so menacing. And he's just, I think it's just fascinating watching him blame everybody else. And it's their fault I'm acting like this, even to the point of blaming God for making him too weak. And that's, he just has these wonderful lines, and Tony J delivers them perfectly. Best supporting actor, Taylor.
Notre Dame.
It's
just
the way they show it and everything. And I mean, between it being a sanctuary and then at the end when Quasimodo uses it to like pour molten lead in order to save Esmeralda. And
yeah,
it's just phenomenal.
I did wonder, because that is a thing at city gates. I can't imagine they actually did that at the cathedral.
I think what he was using is more meant to be like a gutter system.
Yeah.
And Disney just got creative with it.
Yeah,
that's fair, because they did have stuff like that at city gates to keep people out. But I'm thinking, hopefully they weren't arming churches with things to keep people from storming them, but maybe they were. Yeah. 15th century is nuts. But that is high praise for Disney getting it right. If an architect says, you did your architecture correctly, take that praise, Disney. They're listening. Okay. Lizzie, how about you? What's your best supporting?
You know, I actually went with Kevin Kline for Phoebus. I feel like one thing that I really enjoyed about his character is that he had, just like Esmeralda, he had a lot of moral fiber. He was not afraid to stand up to Phoebus, which was probably arguably equally as scary, if not more, for Esmeralda, because he was in, like, he had a direct line to him constantly. So he knew standing up to him was most certainly going to mean death. And even at one point when he saves that family, he's like, it'll be my highest honor. And I don't know. I think Kevin is charming. I love his voice, and I was excited to hear it.
Yeah, we are stride for stride here. I went Kevin Kline as well.
Nice.
I thought his delivery was like the right amount of wit and sarcasm for the character. And in the book, he's not really a likable person, but this is a different take on the character, and I like. He's honestly kind of a better person than Quasi for a while.
Mm-hmm. Like
Quasimodo is ready to strangle him. He gets that weird aggression streak, and Phoebus is essentially saying, we need to work together. And oh yeah, can you let me down?
Yes.
As he dangles him over the staircase. I did like his speech too about how his name's dumb.
I thought he was good.
Hidden gem, Taylor.
Hidden gem. I love Tom Hulce. He's not in a lot of movies, but I loved him in Amadeus. And then when I found out that he was Quasimodo, it was like, oh, he's in, you know, at least one other movie, because he's not in a lot of stuff.
I agree. I tried looking him up on Wikipedia, and you're right. He is not present in a lot of cinema.
He was like in this movie, Animal House, and Amadeus. And that's the only three things I know that he's been in. And then he's been a producer of several Broadway musicals that have done really well. And
his voice changes so much as he sings. It's so different than Quasimodo's voice.
Well, and it's so different from his voice because Amadeus is a very, like Mozart has a very unique voice, and especially a unique laugh. And if you had told me it was the same person, I wouldn't have believed you.
It's a very painful laugh that he chose for Amadeus. Lizzie, who's your hidden gem?
So I thought that I saw this, and then I had to press pause and rewind it.
Oh, are we going to be 3 for 3?
I think we're going to be 3 for 3, possibly. But during Out There, Belle is walking by. And I was like, wait, what? And then I, like, that entire scene from the Bonjour song.
Yeah.
Yes.
This provincial life. Yeah.
It was so cool. I loved that. I had no idea that that was there as a kid. So that was super fun.
Yes. Yeah, I picked Belle as well. And we do get a few crossovers like that. We get Scar in...
He's in Hercules.
Oh, yes, in Hercules. Yeah. Yes, he's like the hat.
Sebastian is in Aladdin.
Yes, and Rapunzel, she's in Frozen, right? She's in Arendelle.
Yep.
So we occasionally get some of those cameos, and that's always fun. So, yep, Out There with Belle. Recast. Who are we recasting, Taylor?
It's not a recast. I would just say just get rid of the gargoyles altogether. If I had to recast someone, y'all are going to hate this. I would say Kevin Klein.
That's fair.
Only because I watch Bob's Burgers and Kevin Klein is in Bob's Burgers. And so now when I hear his voice, I only think of Mr. Fish Odor. So every time he would talk, I was like, he's up to something because he's Mr. Fish Odor.
Okay. All right. Well, that's fair. I'm with you on getting rid of the gargoyles, by the way. Yeah, like, that's fine. Same. Just recast with inanimate gargoyles. That's fine. Lizzie, who are you recasting?
I put Jim Cummings as Quasimodo. I have nothing against our Quasimodo here, but I feel like Jim Cummings is literally in everything, and he's so incredibly talented. And I'm just like, give the man a leading role. Let's see what he does with it. And I think he's so good with changing his voice that I think he probably would be able to do it. After knowing, though, who they were thinking about giving the role to, I definitely want to keep Tony J, but I'd be so down for listening to what Anthony Hopkins would have sounded like as Frollo, because that would have been...
Oh, he definitely would have knocked it out of the park.
Yeah,
I love 100%. Tony J, but Anthony Hopkins would have killed it.
Yeah. I'm with Taylor right up with getting rid of the gargoyles, but I think if you have to do kind of inside jokes with this, get Jason Miller, who played Damian Karras from The Exorcist, get him in as one of the gargoyles. So you can lean into this sister act and priest. I think Charles Kimbrough's Victor, I think he was the most forgettable one. It's Jason Alexander, the female gargoyle, and then this dude. So make them a little more memorable, I guess. But yeah, I just want them out altogether. I just don't think they added something. Or bring Whoopi Goldberg back again. Like, we'll go back to that well, and she will be like John Ratzenberger is for Pixar. Mm-hmm. I love that joke, by the way, at the end of, hey, they're just using the same guy.
What kind of comedy production is this?
Yeah.
Best shot, Taylor.
This one was really difficult, but I'm going to go with the shot in close to the end where Quasimodo is holding Esmeralda up in the cathedral and yelling sanctuary.
Sanctuary.
It's just I don't know what you call it, but like the panning shot around him, and it shows the cathedral, and then it shows like the city of Paris. It's just phenomenal.
It's a really good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've got the swelling music too. Mm-hmm. That is just such a powerful scene. I love it. There are a ton of pretty scenes in this movie. Mm-hmm. Lizzie, what's your best shot?
I went with the very end of the God Help the Outcast song. You have the stained glass and the sun is shining through it. And so the reflection is on the floor and you have Esmeralda standing in the center. But I just think that they did such a beautiful job of capturing the sunlight with all of the colors. And I just feel like that probably had to have been so hard to either draw or do with CGI, because it wasn't just the reflection of the stained glass, it was also the shadows of the sun and like the little flecks of dust coming in. And I was just really, really impressed. And then on top of it, it was just a beautiful shot.
No, that's that whole song is just gorgeous animation.
Agreed. Yeah, it had to be a huge headache just to animate anything inside that cathedral, make it look like it's lit by candles with the stained glass and the sun. Everything about that is remarkable. For me, I'm going to go back to the villain song. Well, the shadows that we talked about, Princess and the Frog, love some shadows there. Love the shadows here. And you see these shadows creeping along the brick, and they're holding crosses up behind Frollo as he sings Hellfire. And it is just bone chilling seeing all these figures that are holding crosses. I almost went with the red robe figures. There's a lot of different things going on in this song, but the shadows with the crosses held up is something that sticks with me. It could very well be something out of The Exorcist that just, it's going to scare that four-year-old that you bring to the cinema. Best scene, Taylor.
Out there, Quasimodo singing and him, like, you know, running around the cathedral, just having a great time, and them showing him on the roofs and all that stuff. Beautiful. And it's such a, Disney had this formula. This was during the Disney Renaissance where all the protagonists had to get an I Want song. And this is Quasi's I Want song. And it's a great one.
Swinging through those bells. Yes. Really incredible. And I wonder if they kind of copy and pasted a little bit of that for Tarzan, because it reminds me a lot of that.
I agree.
Lizzie, what's your best scene?
I put the God Help the Outcasts. That entire scene, I think, is just so beautiful. It's colorful and gorgeous. And like, there's one scene that almost was my best shot where she's walking and you see all these candles that are lighting up her face. And it's just so beautiful to look at. But then the song itself and the messaging and all of it, it's just very powerful. My second would definitely be the Hellfire song, because I'm the villain girly. But I honestly just feel like that whole entire scene is so powerful. It's not just for a children's movie, but just like powerful in general, just to watch for an adult. I thought it was beautiful.
Absolutely. Yeah. Gorgeous song, deserves everything. Both of those are great songs. I too picked a song, but I picked the opening, The Bells of Notre Dame, with Clopin. It just goes so hard. I cannot get over how it starts off so childlike and almost like Shrek, of where we get this storybook and puppets. Yeah. And it very quickly descends into demon horse murder and baby killing. Yeah. And it's like, okay, I'm in for something different. And I love that Disney was brave enough to do that. Best wardrobe and makeup moment. This is a little harder on an animated film. Taylor, what outfit did you like?
I'm going to go with Esmeralda's old man disguise, where she's using her pet goat as her head.
Yes, yes. Jolly with the beard and the pipe.
Yeah.
She uses that twice, too. So
it's does, and nobody notices that there's just a goat sticking its head out of a cloak.
Right. Lizzie?
I went with Esmeralda's green eyes. I felt like that was an interesting choice to make, but they were such a piercing color that you really couldn't help, but you couldn't take your eyes off of her when her face was on the screen. And I imagine that was absolutely intentional, because every single person, every single man is completely captivated by her for different reasons. But everybody is absolutely spellbound by her. And so I think that was absolutely intentional to have something that really just hypnotized you. And I feel like that color was just so piercing and pretty.
So that's actually from the book.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that's why her name is Esmeralda, is because she has green eyes. Because I just Googled really quickly. It is the Portuguese word for emerald.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, they're beautiful. I love it.
Yes. Yeah, she is very striking. And she's one of very few that have green eyes. Let's see, Belle had brown eyes. I'm trying to think if most of them wind up having blue eyes.
Yeah.
So. I think everybody except for Rapunzel and Belle, I think that they have brown, but everybody else has blue. I don't know if there's anyone else that has green eyes.
Yeah, I'm not certain, but they certainly were striking. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting, all the controversy around this film. It winds up getting boycotted due to the choice of Esmeralda. I probably should have mentioned that earlier. But Demi Moore was coming off of Striptease. Mm. And they cast her, and she can't sing, or at least not sing on a level needed for this type of movie. So they get somebody else to sing her parts. But there were religious groups, because this is a movie that has a very strong religious background, religious tones. There were religious groups that boycotted this movie because of Demi Moore being cast.
Wow.
Because she came off of Striptease. That's a bit much. The Disney's response was basically, I haven't really heard any controversy over this movie. Go see it. Yeah. Not enough people saw it, but that's getting worked up over over an actress doing actress things. Yeah. I too went with Jolly. I like a goat with a pipe.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous, and it's something that makes me laugh every time. Mm. The fact that no one is addressing it whatsoever. Jolly doesn't get a lot to do here. I do appreciate that he had an earring for no good reason, too. Like, who's piercing this goat's ears? But, yeah. Right. Yep, Jolly the goat, and especially Jolly as an old man. Change one thing, Taylor.
Get rid of the gargoyles.
We are doubling down on gargoyle hate.
Either that or replace Demi Moore with an actress who can sing. Which she does fine, but it would be nice to have the same actress doing the singing and the vocals.
I considered, and it's funny that Lizzie mentioned it earlier, I considered Brandy. Like getting Brandy, who did Cinderella, and she can sing really good. Yeah.
She has that same raspy tone to her voice, too, that Demi Moore has.
Yeah, it occurred to me in my recast, and it's just funny that you brought up her Cinderella. I think that was just a big thing during our childhood. Like, I can remember that event.
Yes.
So change one thing, Lizzie.
I too would get rid of the gargoyles. That was the change one thing superlative is when I chose to nick that. Specifically the Guy Like You song, I really loathed. But I think in general, they just needed to go.
I feel like they're practicing for Hercules. Like all of this,
I would agree with that. Yes.
It seems like Phil's stuff of Zero to Hero and all these other things that they're training up Hercules, but this is the wrong character to do with. Mm-hmm. I agree with both of you. That was my change one thing. I am going to slightly change it up for the sake of variety though, and just say all the dumb little jokes and like weird sound effects that they throw in. It's so off-putting from the tone that they're otherwise going for. There's like a cartoon frying pan sound and just all the sound effects they chose from their sound bank. You have this incredible, unique, dark movie. Just let it breathe. Let it be incredible and dark. You don't have to throw in Achilles' heel or... Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Goofy sound effects. There's literally a guard that makes a goofy scream for no good reason. Don't do that. Let this movie be unique, Disney. Best quote. I'm intrigued here because there's so many good ones out of this. Taylor, what's your best quote?
I'm going to go with the end of The Bells of Notre Dame, the opening song where Clopin says, "Who's the monster and who's the man?"
Oh, and that's like so
the
good.
Theme of the movie.
That is so good. Yes. Lizzie, best quote.
That was mine as well.
Really?
But I had a second one, and I'll do that. But it's also from The Bells of Notre Dame. Of he saw corruption everywhere except within. Very profound song.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just such a great description of Frollo. With mine, I actually did take a Frollo line. It's from Hellfire. And at the very end, he says, "It's not my fault if in God's plan he made the devil so much stronger than a man."
Yes.
And it's just, he's completely given himself over to evil at this point. of I'm going to blame God because I can't resist temptation.
Yeah.
And incredible. We do get another fun one of Frollo and Phoebus. They're watching Esmeralda dance, and Frollo's like, look at that disgusting display. Yes, sir.
Yes, that was funny.
So I like the like, call to woman. Attention. Yes. Yes. Striking in every way to her own detriment. Mm-hmm. So all these men causing issues for her. Well, it's time for our rating and recommendations. Taylor, on a 0 to 5 star with half star increments, what are you giving The Hunchback of Notre Dame?
I'm giving it 4.5. The soundtrack and the animation are just phenomenal. It does fall short of, you know, perfection. It's not Beauty and the Beast or The Little Mermaid, but it is very close.
It is definitely worth having on your Spotify playlist.
Oh,
Just have this in the background. You will, I don't know what mood you would go for, but I do listen to it. It's like, I don't know if you're feeling religious or spiteful and wanting to burn towns.
Well, I mean, like, this movie is not very popular, but the very end of Out There has become like a viral TikTok sound because it's just that powerful.
Yeah, that was something Disney initially caught flack from for the other religious groups. They were saying, oh, this is overt or covert LGBT themes because they're using the phrase out there. And it probably has been latched onto because it is a song of just being out there in the world. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's no secret gay agenda whatever it was. There were a lot of excuses in addition to choices made by this movie that didn't help. But people were piling on unnecessarily. Lizzie, what's your rating?
I'm going to give this movie a 3.5. I think the music is spectacular. I think the animation is also equally spectacular. My only kerfuffle, I guess, with this movie is that I think a lot of movies that are meant for children kind of toe this line where they don't, it's like an adult theme and then they try to kind of, you know, like whitewash it a little bit. And I think that the story itself probably would have been more powerful if it was told as it truly was meant to be told. But then of course it would take it way out of the bounds of being appropriate for a child. So I think that ultimately the story itself probably just isn't meant to be a child's movie. So I think that's kind of my only qualms with it. It has a hard time finding its true footing and identity in that aspect. I think that it's like you said, the music is like its absolute saving grace and it is absolutely fun to watch, but I don't know if I would feel completely comfortable letting my 8-year-old watch it right now, especially because I don't know if I want to, I don't know if I want to answer all of his questions of like, why is sniffing her hair so bad? And like, why is he so mad? And you know, I don't know. I think I'd have a really hard time explaining all of that because we haven't even crossed over the boundaries of any kind of adult themes with my 8-year-old. So I feel like that's kind of my only thing with it. And of course, you know, there's like all the violence and just bigotry and things that are really big themes that are super hard to explain to a child. So I think that's my main reason why I'm giving it the 3.5. And I think mainly just because it's something that I don't necessarily know if I'm going to see myself revisiting a lot. But I so appreciate that I got to rewatch it as an adult. And I feel like I feel reinvigorated to listen to the music because I think I slept on it a lot as a kid. And so I'm happy to bring that back.
Yeah, I adore the soundtrack and I landed it at 3.5 stars as well. I think you said it well, Lizzie. This movie has an identity crisis and I almost wish a different studio got it so they could make this dark, unique animation that I think this movie needs to be. It needs to go darker at the same time where I wouldn't show it to my 7-year-old either. It's very difficult to explain, okay, we're Christian as well. Here's a church that, and she's like, yay, church. It's like, no, this is not like our church. These are not like our people. They're trying to set fire and kill people. Oh, they can do that. Well, yes, but now here's the history of the Inquisition and everything else. That's more like 10th grade or 10-year-old history, not 10th grade. But
kind of like Coraline. Yeah. You mentioned Coraline earlier. Yeah. That's a movie that definitely is not meant for a younger audience, but it's kind of like a fun, mature, like PG-13.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's got such important themes that I wish it weren't in the Disney canon, but then we wouldn't get the Disney music, and I love the Disney music.
Well, see if there's a musical production near you, go see it, because they lay into the darker themes, but they've got the same songs plus additional ones that Alan Menken and Stephen Schwartz wrote.
Okay. There was an Esmeralda song that was cut, and I think it was put in Hunchback too, which I admittedly have not seen.
Oh, I haven't either.
I haven't seen any of those like straight to video.
Just the Aladdin ones. Those are different.
Disney sequels. But 3.5. So good scores all around. This seems like a lost gem of Disney. Maybe check with your kid. Like everyone's kids are different. Everyone's kids are different. Mine cannot handle it. She just, it was probably Coraline at age 4 that has traumatized her from that point forward. That was terrible parenting. But you will definitely enjoy the music and watch it. Watch it as adults. Got great adult themes, great messaging, wonderful movie. Thank you very much, Taylor, for that choice. Lizzie, do you want to help me pick a movie for next time?
I do, absolutely. Next week is going to be Russell's week because we all know that he's a big, big fan of James Bond.
Are you, Lizzie, right?
Right. I don't know. I don't know if I've watched enough to really qualify myself as one, but definitely I don't know if I'll ever be on Russ's level with that one. So next week we're going to take our podcast, Shaken, Not Stirred. We've got 3 different James Bond movies. Option 1, Live and Let Die from 1973. James Bond is sent to stop a diabolically brilliant heroine armed with a complex organization and a reliable psychic tarot card reader. Option 2, Tomorrow Never Dies from 1997. James Bond sets out to stop a media mogul's plan to induce war between China and the UK in order to obtain exclusive global media coverage. Option number 3, Quantum of Solace from 2008. James Bond descends into mystery as he tries to stop a mysterious organization from eliminating a country's most valuable resource.
You could list Quantum of Solace 3 times and I still would never pick Quantum of Solace. That is a terrible move. Let's go. Michelle Yeoh is huge right now and I'm so happy for her. She is wonderful. Let's go check out Tomorrow Never Dies from 1997. I'm very excited for that. Lizzie, I'm excited for you to give James Bond in another era, another chance.
I'm maybe excited to have a new Bond. Yes.
Maybe we'll find the Bond for you. We'll keep trying. It's probably still going to have the same problems. But that's fine. Thank you, Taylor. Thank you for revisiting the roundtable. Thank you for bringing this movie to us.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on, and thanks for letting me talk about Disney movie for an hour and a half.
Oh, anytime. I love it. That's my wife is a huge Disney nut. It's my daughter is, she's not named after a Disney movie, but she shares a name of a Disney princess. So, yeah. Big Disney fans here. Thank you, Lizzie. Thanks for joining us. And thank you, all the lords, ladies, and knights of the Retro Movie Roundtable. We invite you to reach out to us. We want to hear from you. So please subscribe, rate, review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Pandora, wherever you get your podcasts. It really, really helps us to get those 5-star reviews. It helps other movie fans hear from us. So subscribe to our YouTube channel. It is audio only. Give us a like on Facebook. Follow us on Instagram or Twitter at @movie_retro. And you can email us at retromovieroundtable@yahoo.com. And remember, producing and providing this podcast is fun, but it is not free. So we invite you to support the show at our Patreon page at patreon.com/retromovieroundtable. Any contribution is really appreciated. It goes towards making the show better for you, the listeners. So as always, thank you for listening. Be good to each other and watch more movies. Lizzie?
To love another person is to see the face of God.